realfaith.org.au.
I cannot recall much of the time in prison, but after the war, my father told me that apparently I screamed that loud when they took my baby sister away, that he said that scream was in his head all the time when he was in the different concentration camps, and he never forgot that.
Welcome to Real Faith, conversations about the impact faith has on our lives and the challenges we go through, helping us today and giving us hope for tomorrow. That's real people, real life, and real faith.
You read about the Holocaust in history books and see documentaries and movies about it on TV, but rarely do you get a chance to talk with someone firsthand who experienced it. Well, that's exactly what we'll be doing today, as our guest is Holocaust survivor, Nettie. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us, and let's go right back to the very beginning. You were born in 1938
yes,
in Amsterdam.
In Amsterdam.
And then, of course, the war started just a few years later.
Yes. Yes.
And what are your earliest impressions of your childhood in Amsterdam?
My first impression was really when, during the war, when so many people came to our house, because I was only a young child, and when family was persecuted, they often came and fled to Amsterdam first and stayed with us. And my father, who was working in the underground, he tried to find them places to go into hiding. That is the first impressions I remember as a child.
And we should back up and find out a little bit about your family. Your father was not Jewish, but your mother was.
My mother was, yes, yes. My father worked with the government house in Amsterdam. He had a very high position, and he was able, because of his position and knowing people, he was able to get blank passports and food coupons, and because the Jews couldn't get food coupons, mm-hmm. so he got them and handed them out to the people who needed them, yeah.
Okay, and then the Netherlands were taken over by the Nazis in 1940,
yes.
And they gave your father an ultimatum?
Yes, because of so many Jews living in Amsterdam, most were all integrated with the rest of the people, mm-hmm. and it was not uncommon that non-Jews would marry Jews because of so many Jews living there. And that is how my father married my mum, and he integrated himself completely in the Jewish community. Yeah. And when this ultimatum came that those who were not Jews but married to Jews, if they leave their relationship and divorce, then they wouldn't be persecuted, but they were. And my father wasn't going to leave my mum because he loved her too much, and
wow.
He couldn't see, to leave her and with two children, and no way. It was his wife, and he wanted to protect her.
And as you mentioned earlier, he went on to help out with the resistance.
Yes, and what so often happened is was so busy helping so many other people to get out of the country. And it is recorded that he helped 220 Jews to escape.
Oh, wow.
But the thing is, he never got time to organize his own paperwork for his own family, and that often happens, isn't it?
So if he would have just thought about himself, he could have got his whole family out.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was so busy helping others. Wow.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
And then because we had so many Jewish family coming through our house to escape from the country where they were living, our neighbors started to become suspicious with all these people coming and going. And in the end, it was too dangerous for us to stay there, and we had to leave ourselves.
And just as a side note, you mentioned to us before we started to record that the general population went on strike in support of the Jews.
Yes, yes, for 3 days until it was repressed by the Nazis. But Yeah, the whole, because that is when they realised that Jews were taken out of the houses and been transported out. Yes.
Okay, so getting back to your father's situation, he realized it was getting dangerous?
Yeah, and at first we apparently moved to a house. I can't remember much, only I remember that I wasn't allowed to take any toys with me and I missed my teddy bear. And that was that is all I remember from the first place. The second place was with my mother's eldest sister, and that is when I remember quite a bit more of that, but we only stayed there for just under a fortnight because that is when a cousin of my father was arrested with a suitcase full of paperwork and false passports and coupons, you know.
For so this. He was helping out the resistance?
Yes. And that is when we... that is when the resistance movement very quickly got us out of that house there. And that is when we were moved to Harlem. I found a small two-bedroom place where we moved into, and then together actually with my grandmother. And my mother's youngest brother came later, about half a year later. They came. He came as his wife to stay, and also one of my cousins.
And if I understand it correctly, that was the general area that Corrie Ten Boom was in?
Yeah, not that far from the center where Corrie Ten Boom's father had the shop, yeah.
Okay, so if people are familiar with her story, that's kind of the general area where you were hiding.
Yes.
So at this point in the story, you're about 5, 6 years old?
5 years. When we moved to Harlem, I was 5 years, yeah.
Okay, and you're told just to be quiet all the time.
Yes, my brother and I weren't allowed to play out. Actually, we had to have the windows all darkened up, and there was no light in the house, a natural light coming in. And, we weren't allowed to go outside at all.
What were you thinking was going on? This was just normal for you?
Well, a child very quickly adapts, mm-hmm. and... Yeah. Just took it all in our stride, I would say, yeah.
So at the time, obviously, you're only 5, 6 years old. You're not knowing about the political situation War II and everything.
That's right.
You're just obeying your parents.
Yeah.
And how long did that go on?
Actually, when we moved in that house, that was in August 1943. And the 31st of May 1944, that is the day we were found out and been arrested.
Okay, yeah. Before we get to that fateful day, were you struggling? Was it hard to just be hiding all the time?
No, not for me. Yeah, I had my parents there, my grandmother and uncle and aunt, and they kept us occupied and, so...
It wasn't terrible. It wasn't like you were in prison.
No, not rigid.
Okay.
No.
I'm just trying to relate to if I was that age, having to be quiet all the time.
Yeah, it's because, it probably was first in the beginning very hard for my parents to teach us to be quiet. No, not to yell or...
Yeah, because kids make noise and you run around.
That's right. But we soon... adapted to that, and
But then your mother had a baby.
Yes.
Now you can tell 5, 6-year-old children to be quiet. I don't know how you tell that to a baby.
You can't tell a baby. No, I know. And that is when it got to my mum, and she couldn't cope at all, and it was just getting too much for her, and she just begged my father at the time, we need to go out, And then in the end, when my baby sister was only 2 weeks old, he gave in. And we had only just left the house. And you know how sometimes there are things that you remember that is like a clear picture, like image in your mind that you never leave. Mm-hmm. And that is what happened that day. Because I can remember exactly how it was. My mum and my dad, they were wheeling the pram, and I remember my brother just happily running in front.
Were you excited to be outside?
Yeah, because that is when we first time we went outside on the street, and we were only going to go just around the block because my mother wanted to buy a birthday present for me because my birthday came up, my sixth birthday. And it wasn't very long, not even 5 minutes, I would say, that in my inner child's eye, this person was very tall because he was taller than my parents, and my parents were small. But in my child's eye, he was this very tall man in a uniform and who spoke a language I couldn't understand. It wasn't Dutch, it was German. And straight away questioned my father because they were looking for him. And so they must have had a photo of him.
Just 5 minutes.
We were only no more than 5 minutes out on the street, and we were arrested right there and then. We'd taken over the bridge straight into a police station. I remember that.
Our guest today is Holocaust survivor Nettie, who was in hiding not too far from where Corrie ten Boom was living during World War II. We've just heard how, unfortunately, her family was arrested by the Nazis. We'll hear what happens next in her life when we return right here on Real Faith.
Looking for resources to grow your faith? Check out Vision Christian Store with books, movies, audio CDs, DVD resources and more. Plus, free delivery on orders over $50. See visionstore.org.au.
You're listening to Real Faith, conversations with real people about how God works in their lives. If you want to know more about integrating faith into your life, our website is realfaith.org.au. That's realfaith.org.au. Just go to the website and you'll find helpful articles about the impact faith can have on your life. And you can listen to past programs about the impact faith has had on others. Once again, that's realfaith.org.au.
Welcome back. I'm Eric Scadabo, and our guest today is Holocaust survivor Nettie, sharing her life journey. Before the break, we heard how her family was arrested by the Nazis after they had been in hiding not too far from where Corrie ten Boom was living during World War II. Next, we'll find out what happened after they were taken to the local police station.
A lady from the Red Cross came in and just wheeled the pram away. And
your younger sister?
Yeah, didn't know why. And the next thing, we were in prison, in the local prison in Harlem.
In your child's mind, are you thinking, hey, what did we do wrong? Did that come to your mind?
Well, the whole problem is I cannot recall much of the time in prison. But after the war, my father told me that apparently I screamed that loud when they took my baby sister away, when we seemed to be getting separated, that he said that scream was in his head all the time when he was in the different concentration camps, and he never forgot that. And my father never talked about the war afterwards until we were married already, much older, and he told us a few things. And the first thing that is what he told me, that he's never forgotten that. And my own doctor, I had a lovely Jewish doctor here in Melbourne where we were living in the beginning, and he said sometimes with that, things block out. And he said, and then don't go there. And I haven't. I don't want to know. But the time in prison, I cannot remember. Only that all the children were all of a sudden called out, and a whole group of children, Jewish children, and we stood there. And I remember these big trucks coming up, and I saw my mum had to climb on the truck, and I was waving goodbye to her, thinking that I'll see her again soon. And that was it. And we were all taken to the local orphanage.
So you're separated from your parents.
And that was so strange because normally children, half families would go to the camps, you know. And I mean, I've got I did some research on my family, and it was even from one of my cousins, was even a 78-day-old baby that was killed at Auschwitz, you know. So why them and not us? You never know.
Yeah,
I like to think that we might have had a Christian soldier there that was in charge that couldn't cope with and saved all the children. But that day when my mother was taken on that truck, all those children in the prison were taken out, taken to the orphanage.
What happened to your mother?
Actually, my parents were both separated. My father went to a place in Holland called Vught, and the other one was taken to Westerbork, was another place in Holland. I visited that place, and that is where the Jews first were sent to, and from there to Auschwitz. After a few days, when I was in that orphanage, there was a distant family member from my father's side who I'd never met before. And they were contacted through the Red Cross. And she came and she took me and my brother back to Amsterdam. And my grandmother from my father, his mother, that's where we stayed overnight. And I remember that so clearly, because he was this lady that was going to take me to her home in The Hague, and I was there with my brother. And I remember my grandmother, she had beautiful furniture, and I remember her pulling two big armchairs together and making up a bed for me to sleep. And it's such strange things that you remember, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the next day we had to go on the train, and it took ages because, you know, a lot of the time the railways were bombed down and you had to get out and walk again and then go on to another train. But when we finished up back in The Hague, and where this family left, it was only a husband and wife because she couldn't have children of her own. And she just took me in like her own child. She really, they were really lovely for me. But the life in The Hague during that last year of the war was shocking.
Yes, I mean, it's historic how terrible it was.
And I remember, you know, one point we had to have all our windows blocked out. And as a child, you know, you want to see what is going on. And
but apparently by that time, you're kind of used to that type of thing.
Yes, but still, you know.
Oh,
you're still children
of
children,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, pulling away the curtain a little bit to see what was on. And all I could see was this soldier across the road already standing, a whole row of soldiers all standing ready with their guns to shoot. And it was one of those days that, and I came, first they came, you know, once in a while to the house to search for young men who would be hiding, because all young men had to go to Germany to work.
Oh, this was any young man, Jewish
any,
or
non-Jewish?
Oh,
no, not the Jews. This was just the normal population. And all men, I think from under 40, had to go to Germany to work, and they didn't want to, you know, and they went into all sorts of hiding places, you couldn't imagine. And
up in the roof and
in cupboards, everywhere, under the floors, and, you know, wherever they could make a hiding place. And so then they came searching every house in the street, and first that was, you know, once in a while, but then towards the end of the war it became more regularly. And it was just very scary because I was very scared when they came in the house, and I would crawl in the cupboard, or I would crawl under the bed, or I was, and
Now, were you in hiding because you were Jewish
again? Family, yeah. But they didn't know that I wasn't their child.
Oh, okay. Oh, they thought
they had changed my name.
And because your father's family was non-Jewish, these relatives were not Jewish.
Yeah. No.
Oh, so you changed your name.
Yeah, my grandmother decided that when this lady had picked me up from Harlem, from the orphanage, that when I came to my grandma's place, she said, we have to change the name, because Natty at the time was very popular among the Jewish community. Okay. And there was a church across the road where my grandmother was, and it was a Catholic church called St. Agnes, and she said, oh, let's call her Agnes. And so I became Agnes.
Oh, and okay. So suddenly you're told you're Agnes now.
Yeah. And so it was just to keep me safe. That is why they called me that. And but when we were in The Hague, we often, when they found young men to, you know, they would be taken to the local square, and they would round us all up, the whole street, all the people. We all had to go to the square to witness those young men being shot. And that, as a child, I was, you know, 6 and a half, by then 7, coming close to 7, that was something I never forget, because you just, you know, it's just horrible.
Yeah. So that was intimidation. It was
That was really.
In other words, if you disobey, this could happen to you.
Yeah. Or to your sons.
And then, at the lowest point, if I understand correctly, the Nazi army surrounded your town, The Hague.
Yeah, they closed off. They did.
So no food could come in.
No food. Farmers couldn't bring in their food, and by then, you know, all what was in the town itself was complete. And people who had their own businesses, you know, or like shops, they wouldn't give away the food. You know, they kept it for their own families. And that is when.
So, what did you eat?
Well, this auntie where I was staying with, she went at night often, went to the schools where the Germans were camped, and that is when she steals the potato peels, and would come home and she scrubs them clean and cooked them, and that is all we had to eat, because we had no food. So you stayed in bed in the morning until halfway, and then you got up, had for lunch, you had potato peels, and went to bed early because there was no food.
And what do potato peels taste like?
Horrible.
So, but you don't have pleasant memories of these?
No way, no way.
But you had to.
But you had to, because there was nothing else. And when you're hungry, you eat.
Yeah.
And
so that lasted a year?
So no, that was only for a few months. And
that was the worst of the worst.
That was the worst, And then we heard all these planes coming over and dropping off parcels, and that is when we had stale bread.
Tell us about that. It tasted like cake.
My auntie said it just was like dry stale bread with nothing on it. And my auntie said it tasted like cake, but I didn't know what cake tasted. So never had cake in my life.
So these were Allied planes?
Yeah, from the Allies. Yes, dropping over.
Dropping food parcels. Yeah. But you said it was stale bread, but it tasted
beautiful.
Because it was a whole lot better than potato peelings.
Yes.
So that was toward the end of the war.
That was the end of the war, yeah.
And then finally, liberation?
Liberation, and it was strange because although, you know, people came out and shouted, you know, we're free, and you still seem to be in this that way of thinking that you are free, that you really can walk on the street without, you know, being arrested or anything. I think it really got into the people's mindset as well, yeah. But the thing was, my auntie started to look for a school where I could go to, because the local school, they had to be cleaned out, and the Germans had been camping there. And then by the time I went to school, see, the problem was, because she never had any children of her own, she didn't know what to do with me. And they never gave it a thought of teaching me in that time how to write my name, I completely did not know anything.
Oh, so, I mean, just one of the side effects of the war was you weren't being schooled.
No.
So you didn't know how to write?
No.
And all that?
I mean, my mother would have taught me you know, how to write my name and that. Yeah. And I knew a bit, but I only knew how to write Nettie. But I was Agnes now, and I had no idea how to write that name. But anyway, when I went to school, I had to start off, I was 7 years old, and I was to start off at the lowest grade, even how to write my name and count. And that was hard, but it was the hardest thing was that after a few days, some of the children came up to me and they said, my mum and dad said that we're not allowed to play with you because you are a Jew.
That was part one of our three-part conversation with Holocaust survivor Nettie sharing her life journey. At this point in this story, mercifully, the war has come to an end, the evil Nazi regime has been defeated, but next time we'll hear how Nettie experiences another form of injustice, anti-Semitism. Also, we'll hear how she goes for a search for God. All that's coming up next time, right here on Real Faith.
You've been listening to Real Faith, and if you have any questions or comments, you can send us a message through our website, realfaith.org.au. That's realfaith.org.au.
This program is a production of Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, see vision.org.au.